This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2021, held at Faith Builders from August 2 through 6.
Thank you for coming to this classroom management class. Glad you're here to just for us to talk together about classroom management and in particular, we have in mind today the long arc. It's the way I'm talking about classroom management. And if you were in my first presentation, I'm going to give you just a little bit of a different shot on this. I used to be an airplane pilot. I don't know. What struck me, but at 16 years of age, I decided that I'd go get an airplane pilot's license, and my mom said I was nuts, and she was on track. So I did, and I had. It's one of those experiences of taking an opportunity that taught me a lot of things. I know nobody believes this, but I was very, very shy in school. I didn't say much. I really enjoyed school, but rather shy, and I'll never forget when I did my first solo flight. I flew from Chambersburg to somewhere in Delaware, and my instructor said, "No, you have to go up to the desk and get somebody's signature so that on your logbook to make sure that we know that you actually were there." I have no idea why that scared the death out of me, but I did it. But the little story on it, two stories, but one illustration and then a story. The illustration is I flew with what they called VOR systems. Now today you might, it's GPS as you would expect. And I tell pilots, new pilots today, I say, "You guys are, you're pampered." I mean, they just go up there and they have a little screen and they can see where they're at, and it tells them what to do and all of that. Well, back in the day I was flying, you couldn't, there's nothing like that. There were VOR systems and there were what they called DME systems. The DME systems were interesting because if you were flying from here, let's say, going this direction, and you wanted to go here, to this location, if they had a DME there, it put out a radio signal that inside of the airplane there was an instrument, and the instrument would point toward that station. Okay? Well, here's the thing. So you couldn't see the station, right? Well, unless you were right there, but normally you're a couple, 100 miles away or 150 miles away or whatever. So it lets you know that, and obviously, if that's where you want to go, you're going to orient the plane that direction. DMA systems, though, they didn't account for wind. So a VOR system does, because it just sends out a straight signal, and if you're on it, you get on it, you fly in that straight signal, right? And you just adjust the plane to stay on that thing. This thing just points toward the location. That's all it does. Whether you're up here or whether you're wherever you're at. So if you have a strong wind, let's say, going this direction, and you oriented the plane going like this, right? That wind's gonna blow you off course, and you're gonna fly an arc like this. Okay, because it'll keep pointing there, but as it keeps pointing, you know, it just the arrow keeps going this direction. And unless you're a very, very experienced pilot and paying attention to that wind, why, you can fly twice the distance you thought you were going to fly. Theoretically, you can get way up here somewhere and come in. World War II pilots almost all had to fly these systems. And they were really good. They always told us at the airport, never challenge a World War II pilot on a DMA system, DME system. They'll fly circles around you, or you'll fly circles around them. The long arc is what we're talking about here. and it's really not getting off course so much, is it's making the adjustments to head toward a target that you can't see. This is how it differs from the nuts and bolts of everyday, day in and day out classroom management. I already said management's the wrong term here. It should probably be disciplined, or it should be, should say something a little different, because I'm not thinking right now of what Caleb was thinking about. I'm thinking about 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, and the kinds of things that you're doing in the classroom today that actually will bring to fruition, will come to good fruition years downstream. And I could tell you a couple of stories. Probably one that comes to mind just now is a student I had in school. And if you were in my first session, this is actually a different student than the one I mentioned then. A student that I had in school who, if I were just to use a strong word, he was trifling. A reasonably good brain, handsome, capable, but he got by with the very, very, very least he could possibly get by with. In fact, I won't go into the details, but this particular gentleman tried my patience so thoroughly that he never got a diploma. He just simply did not. But he did something much better than that. Years went by, let's just say it that way. He gets married, and he has a number of children, and he farms, and he's done very well as a farmer, but it's maybe, I don't know, 25, 30 years downstream, and I go home to Chambersburg, and I go to the church where Sheila, my wife, grew up, Rowe Mennonite Church, and sat down on a Sunday morning, and don't you know, Sam stands up to preach. He's ordained today, mind you. He's a deacon in the church. And I I was sitting there and I thought, oh my goodness, what is this gonna be? I was absolutely astounded. The brother delivered a speech according to a sermon, according to protocol. He even did what we taught him. He didn't in school, but he did there when he was preaching. And I'm like, how did that happen? You know, the Lord has his way of doing this. Do we feel like we failed? And we probably did. And yet the Lord can take some of these things that we actually work on day in and day out, and in his own good time, in his own good way, he brings it to fruition. I can't tell you how delighted and excited I was that morning. The poor guy got up and he said, you know what, I'm not scared of anybody here except one person. And I'm like, pray tell why I didn't. But believe me, we had a good chat after the service, and I just blessed him over and over again. And it was, honestly, I have no clue. It felt to me like whatever I did held it back and didn't push it forward. But I was so delighted to see that. I could tell you opposite stories. In fact, I've quit predicting outcomes. Simply because there were some students I had, I thought they were really going to go good places. And somehow or another, by the time the story was actually told, I'm thinking of a young lady, a very, very fine young lady, divorced today. I thought, sure, this was going to be, had to be high success, and it did not. Why am I saying this? Everything that I'm going to tell you that talk about here in the next 50 minutes or so needs to be clothed in a great deal of humility. If you don't see it in me, know that I want it that way. Just simply because we do not have the skill and the ability to control and manage and make things work. We sow seed. We do train. We do discipline. Believe me, I take that seriously. I work hard at it. But I've been at it long enough to know that Melvin Layman does not have the skill to manipulate people and manage people and make them do this, that, or the other thing. There really is a God in heaven who oversees all of this and can take a few words we speak or a bit of discipline that's offered or whatever and change lives over the long haul. And the long arc, the mark gets hit. But I think the Lord teaches us along the way that it gets hit not because we were so smart or so good at doing something, but because the Lord himself does know how to intervene and take even a few broken remarks that one may make at some point and change lives. That does excite me, that the Lord is able to do that. Well, so that's what we're talking about here, and that's why classroom management is kind of the wrong term here when we're thinking long arc. And how can we think of, keep that long arc in mind when we're teaching students and when we're bringing into our classroom various levels of, if you want to call it management, okay, but the discipline and so on. Three levels of classroom management here. Now you have some spaces here that you can fill in. So how many first-year teachers here? Okay. You'll probably find yourself in mode one there, survival mode kind of to begin with. And the reason I raised this one and the second one, targeted behavior correction and heart formation, is because don't let this class derail you from the things that Caleb would have taught if you were in his class. And if you weren't in his class, I can tell you, get the notes or something. The nuts and bolts of classroom management do need to be mastered up front. And for me, Caleb was just telling me here that something I told him a number of years ago, he's not forgotten, and that he was going to be a school teacher, and I said, well, okay, make sure you teach at least 3 years before you decide whether you're going to stick with it or not. And I'll say that to the rest of you too if you haven't. It was not until my third year that I started to feel a little bit of comfort. okay, this actually fits my hand, and it wasn't until I taught for 5 years that I said, you know what, I'm going to be a career teacher. Now, there's a story behind that, actually, as the Lord, at 18, 19 years of age, if you'd have said to me, I think that you should teach school, I'd have said, there's something wrong with upstairs somewhere. Because you couldn't, and my wife has always, she said, when we got married, she said, well, I'm not going to marry a farmer nor a teacher. Well, she married both. I teach today and I have a little farm up there. Okay. It was kind of like, well, the Lord has his ways of bringing about things. And so those first couple of years for me, I just want to just confess to you, they felt like survival years. I taught with John D. Martin first 6 years of my teaching career. And in those years, I myself was in a discipline class. John announced, I'll never forget this, he announced when we sat together to plan for the first year when I was teaching, he said, now we'll have chapel 5 times a week. And it'll be 40 minutes long. I'll do Monday, you'll do Tuesday, I'll do Wednesday. No, I'll do Monday, you'll do Tuesday. We'll have a visitor on Wednesday. I'll do Thursday and you'll do Friday. Two sermons. I mean sermons. You know John D. Martin? It'd be one thing if you were just on your own, but you know, so he's going to do Monday and now I'm going to do Tuesday and I'm going to hold forth for 45 minutes and I'm like, boss after, sure. I have never been through the ringer like that in my life. survival. You don't let me make it sound too bad. It's not that bad, really. And I'm saying do learn what it takes to manage a classroom at that level. The next level there is targeted behavior correction. So once you kind of get a little bit under your belt, now you can start to look around and say, what do I need to do here to correct this little thing that goes wrong? Or over here, Sam, that how could I help him a little bit? And so on. I found myself in that mode. And then the third one here is really what I'm thinking when I'm thinking long arc. How am I touching the hearts of the children in my life, in my classroom? And I've already made the disclaimer that if we think that we have the skill and the ability to do that, we'll think twice. But we have opportunity to do what we know how to do, and then the Lord can take it from there. And that's sort of what we're talking about here. Two questions. First one I have for you is, can a student's heart worldview be shaped by intellectual exercise alone? The obvious answer, at least the obvious answer, I think, is the correct answer is no. Clearly you have to think right. I'm not arguing that at all. And a large part of school is about asking the questions and shaping and forming the intellect in terms of what is it that God wants, and so on. So, of course, it has that big effect. My question is, so what else does? That's the other part of education that needs to be given an awful lot of thought. What actually forms the hearts of the next generation? And that's what we'd like to talk about here a bit. The second question is there a back door to the heart? What do I mean by that? Well, a back door to the heart, let me say it differently. If I am talking to somebody who has a different worldview than me, or even, I'll make it even stronger, a student from my community who comes from a family, they're kind of on the fringe to begin with on a number of things, let's say. And here's his family in my school, and I have opportunity to teach them. I tell you what not to do. Don't try a frontal attack on their worldview. In fact, almost never try a frontal attack. Never forget a student I was teaching biology, and I didn't know this, but do you know that cows do not have sweat glands, so they don't sweat. Okay, so I'm teaching this, and I saw this girl in the back of the room, and she's kind of like, so Sally, what are you thinking? My dad says cows do have sweat. Cows do have sweat glands. Oh, okay. It's not really a worldview question, but it's. Your impulse or my impulse is to intellectually wrestle that to the ground. For some reason, God gave me enough grace right then to say, you know what, Sally, go home and ask your dad about that, and maybe he'd call the local veterinarian and ask him if that's true. Because you know what? It's not like I really know. It is what it says in the text. And I did grow up on a dairy farm, and after I thought about it, it is true that when the cows got soaking wet from rain, they were wet when they came in, or the dew or whatever. But you know what? As I recall, I don't think they did sweat much, if at all. And she came back the next day, and the argument was over. I didn't have to say anymore. The veterinarian said, yeah, they get wet now and then, but they don't have sarcoids. Okay. No, that's what I mean by not making a frontal attack. Okay. Open the back door. So what I want to share with you is a way, and notice I'm saying open the door. I get a little disturbed sometimes when we trifle with people's hearts. I'm not sure if that's fair. But I don't mind opening the door, saying, hey, would you let that door open and take a look in here, see what's going on there? And that's what I mean by this. Three important heart questions. And these are the questions that if you can lead students to think about and consider, very, 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 I think, some of the more important questions that must be asked. So what do you highly value and why do you value it? Again, if you attack a student's values head on, you just say, you're crazy, four, fill in the blank. You almost never win that one. In fact, you'll get a reaction. You just entrench people normally in a position if that's the case. It's far better to lead them to ask the question themselves. So why do I do that? Pray tell. And is that really a value that I want to hang on to for years to come? So take, say, clothes, or take athletics, or take sports, or professional sports, or I don't know, just fill in the blank there for whatever it might be the issue in your community. But there's the young people, the students in your school, they're always bent. And I was a young fellow. I had all kinds of ideas and notions, and it took years. I still have some value issues. Okay, I keep trying to lay them before the Lord and say, is this really, really, really worth what I'm doing? I think I shared in the other class or one of my classes about lawns. You know, one of my good friends, he's dead now, from Eastern Europe, grew up under the communist years. And by the way, the guy had spent 2 years in the prison munitions camp under Hitler, helping to create explosives. A very, very fascinating story, but that's not the story I want to tell you. This, but his values had really, really been shaped by his experience. And he was questioning me. He said, I have no clue why in the world you all do with your lawns what you do. I don't get it. So you, if you walked into his front yard, what he had was a kind of a herbal garden of some kind, and did a few tomatoes and a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and a very, very, very small a patch of grass. And he had one of those old mowers out back, one of those old Briggs & Stratton mowers that looked like it needed a whole lot of help, but mowed just a little wee space. So what do? You go out there and you mow and you mow and you mow and you mow and you, and then you fertilize so it grows more so you can mow more. That is like, I have no idea. What in the world did you do that for? Well, I still do it, mind you. But I got his question. His question is, are you thinking about why you highly value that? Why do you care about it at that level? And I'll tell you what I concluded. I concluded that I accepted a Western cultural value and just swallowed it. And as a result of swallowing it, I do it. Okay, well, it's better just to admit that, okay, it might, this thing might have to be straightened out some, but that's the value I'm living at. I don't have a verse in the Bible, that's for sure, that says that I'm going to spend 2 hours taking care of my lawn every week. Or it suggests I ought to, but there is a cultural value pushes me harder. I find it useful to let my students know I'm still working on values. Now here's one that I just admit I'm a little troubled by, why I'm putting that much investment there. And what do I want? I want that back door to open for them. For them to ask the question, what about mine? What am I stuck on here? Why am I putting all that time into volleyball or basketball? You name it. I don't know what the blanks are here, but whatever they are. That's the question there. Who or what do you trust and why so? COVID really underscored this. And just to let you in a little bit of peace on how I tried to process that and think about it in school. So, you all know, our communities were all over the map on this thing, and it was hard to get it figured out. And I'm a church leader, too, and so the school here was actually practicing something a little different to what our church was practicing. I'm a little in the crossfire here trying to navigate the water and all of that.
But Sheila and I, as we talked about it and prayed over, we said, you know what? In the end, we want to, in some fashion, let our children and our grandchildren and people around us know that our primary trust is in God. It's not that we disregard what medicine has done and so forth and so on. In fact, in general, we try to pay attention to that and do. But at the end of the day, we want it to bleed through that our trust is in God. Not in human. So Psalm 91, I know people made fun of it and they stuck things out in their yards and they did this, but we memorized Psalm 91 and almost every morning I would quote that to myself and pray it. And just one more time say, God, look, masking or not masking, we're trusting you. And we believe it really is within the possibility of your hand to care and protect. And we'll do what we can do to be reasonable here, but we're trusting you. Okay, I'm not saying we did it perfectly, but do you see what our goal was? We wanted to, for ourselves, in whatever we were communicating to others, our trust is first and foremost in God Almighty. Secondarily, sure, there are things here that we do. And we hear people talking, and we hear the experts, and we question them a little bit. It's kind of like, well, they've got something to say, but they're not God, that's for sure. So understand me, I still don't make big statements about COVID, except to say, I want to be sure that my heart's at the right place here, okay? And that in the end, we trust God Almighty. All right, I just use that as an example to say what. So in school, Richard was here, and you probably didn't hear me say much about it. Okay, I just didn't. I kept telling people what I told my friends. I said, well, when the bricks start flying, I just keep my head down. And third here, who or what is the ultimate authority in answering life's questions? Ladies and gentlemen, this is, I think, perhaps the question of this generation. Because these two are really quite related, the trust issue and the authority issue. By authority, I don't mean who's the big dog in the room. I mean, who do we trust with the answer? Or the answers, the scripture, where do we go for it? Who is the ultimate authority? I think probably in this room, we would all say that the scriptures and Jesus are final authority, and full agreement there. Back up there. What are your thoughts? I want to go back to that slide just so that give you a chance to respond there. Do you have any comments? What do you find? How does that translate into your school? Any ideas, stories you have to tell about values, trust, authority? Classroom management, again, wrong term, but what happens in my classroom that affects these pieces? Any comments, questions? Caleb, how's it working out for you?
I think the question I was thinking about more is, what do I do when the things my students value are different from what I value? And that's kind of the question I guess I have about this slide.
Some. What do you all do? So what about when your values are, what you hope to communicate value-wise is pretty dramatically different than what students, can I add to that, and maybe the students' parents as well?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. Then what?
I think you definitely have to know that it's the ultimate authority is God and His Word. Mm-hmm. And so, I have values that I think are important, but maybe they're not scriptural based. But if you know this is a scriptural value and you take the backdoor approach and you just, that little tiny nudge, well, it's just to get that, the wheels turning, uh-huh. I think it's huge. But if it is just your personal value, there's no reason to give the nudges then, forget it.
Uh-huh. That's good. That's good. So, excellent. Who else?
I spend a lot of time communicating with the parents.
Uh-huh.
I know where the parents, their viewpoint on almost all the issues are, so I know how to handle
students.
How old are you, brother?
23.
You're doing some good work there.
Okay, so developing a relationship with mom and dad is an excellent thing. Who else?
I've often had, I taught first and second grade.
But, sure.
And I've often had the little students like ask me big questions.
Oh, yeah.
And I may not know exactly where the parents stand on it. I mean, I can kind of guess, but so I usually just go ahead and answer it to the best that I can. And uh-huh. if they come and say, well, their parents disagree, then I can deal with that.
Sure.
But you can't just stop and call the parents right then. So sometimes I just go ahead and answer.
Sure. I like the freedom that you're speaking of there. So you go ahead and talk to them. If there's an issue comes up, then you deal with that. Probably by talking with mom and dad or backing off a little bit. Or okay, that's good. Who else? I'll say this about it. The reason I ask you about your age is you... to affect the values of a community, to push back against pretty firmly entrenched values in a community that you don't share, is a long-term thing. And you earn your wings there. He's doing the right things. He's first of all developing a relationship with parents, maybe asking them a few questions. What I have found is that this is a long-term investment if you really want to affect the culture and values of a community. Really long-term. It's the advantage of a long-term faculty, a faculty that's been there for a while. They have a better chance at doing this. And you said you've taught for three years. Caleb, I honestly know you a little bit. My guess is that if you hang in there, if you, pardon the terminology, play your cards right, you'll have a growing capacity and platform to speak into the value system. Remember this. Students and parents, particularly parents, have the right to ask you to, even though they don't know how to ask you to demonstrate what you mean. So after so many years, you and the missus, you have three children, and they see how these values are working out, and whether you, what you do in terms of the phones, do you give them phones when they're just youngsters, or what do you do? How do you actually handle that? And then they begin to say, oh, well, he does actually have a set of values that he's working out. Don't hear me saying that Caleb does not have the right to speak now. That's not my point. My point is you have a growing authority to speak as you live it out in a group of people. And I'm surprised. No, I shouldn't be surprised. It takes a while to earn enough respect and to have enough experience under your belt that there's the trust issue, that people would trust you. Excellent. Who else has something to say about this issue? You know, my call here for you need to earn your right, to don't hear me pulling you back from speaking into the values of a community. I'm not saying that. Just remember that you do have to earn a certain right to speak into those values. Others?
I guess one thing that kind of on the flip side of this thing of when your students' values differ from yours, and it's one thing that we faced at our school a little bit, is with the church school setting, to sometimes if there's a more conservative teacher than what the church actually is.
Mm-hmm.
To be careful, yes, you can speak into that and into the back door.
Sure.
But be careful not to push stricter or more, or to your values onto the students that are within the church's boundaries, if you know what I'm saying.
Sure.
I mean, I think the temptation is to, or the problem is more of how to approach probably bigger in a community school type setting, but within the church school, you're hired by the church, and to if you differ with the church, if that makes any sense.
Oh, well, absolutely. My son's taught in other communities, and I always told them, so when you go to that community, you respect their traditional values, and if there's one you want to push back on, there's a way to do that, but don't be undermining the community expectations that are there. Either way, but work at it. You know?
This was in my home community, mind you, that came to mind as soon as you started saying that. So I'm principal, right? Yeah, watch me just open a can of worms here like you wouldn't believe. I'm principal, and our church standard says black footwear. The youngsters, this was back during the time when white sneakers were the rage. I don't, anybody remember that? I mean white, solid
right
white.
Now.
Oh, they are now.
Right now.
Okay. Well, they were then. I mean, white high tops were the rage. Okay. Well, so of course, as you might expect, the boys wore them to school. I think the girls did some too. I can't remember for sure, but and mind you, most of the adult community, they certainly didn't wear black ones. I don't know what they wore. If you went to a picnic, they wore something else. Well, the board told me that I had to enforce this black footwear, and I'm like, gentlemen, okay. I'm under your authority, and if that's what you expect, believe me, it'll happen. But I have a question for you. And there were a couple pastors there. I said, can you help me understand why you're not enforcing it? So I'm pushing on the values here, and I'm pushing on the way administration is actually done, and I'm saying, you're expecting me to do something? So I just ask them bluntly, so you want me to stand at the front door on day one? Because I will do this if this is what you're telling me to do, but I'll be mad about it. You want me to stand at the door, and everybody that comes in with white shoes, I'm supposed to tell them to turn right around and go get other ones. Is that what you want me to do? Well, we got it worked out, ironed out in the long run, but I felt that tension between the values of a section, a group of people in the community, and a much larger group that had a different set of values, and I'm supposed to navigate these waters. Okay, and some of you, I'm sure you've been in their shoes before. Well, there's a time to address another value. But it's a backdoor one. What is brotherhood about? So all I was asking them, is it really fair of you to ask in this brotherhood, to ask somebody, and it happens to be me right now, ask somebody in this to enforce a value that a couple of you here really hold dearly for whatever reason, and I'm supposed to enforce that across the community. Do you see where that puts me? What kind of shoes that puts me in? Could we? Shoes, yeah. No pun intended there, but could you rethink that? Could we sit together? I don't know who needs to sit together and talk about this. I will be under your authority. Okay, but do you hear my question? And they did. There was within a month or so, they said, okay, first of all, we're still gonna ask that, but we won't ask you to enforce it until we, and I said, okay, and look, I can tolerate a whole lot, but I just, and believe me, I want to be supportive, but I don't quite know how to be supportive here when I know that my students will leave here, they'll go to a picnic this evening, and the grandpa's there will be wearing white shoes. Enough said. we better leave this one, but And here's the thing, if you're a long-term teacher, by the time this discussion was happening, you know, I'm 38 years old or something like that, 35 years old, because I came here when I was 38, in my early 30s, and had taught school for a while, and I had a little bit of trust in my bank account by that time. And so I could actually ask those kind of questions. Oh, and by the way, here's what my church community knew. They knew that at the end of the day, I was committed to the community. You have a lot of room to work on this stuff if that commitment is upfront. They know that, okay? And if they don't, well, then that becomes an issue. Okay, need to move on here, but very fascinating. Attitude, skills of the heart. I've got to go through these relatively quickly. They're kind of paired here. So I want my students to have a can-do attitude. This really is a heart orientation. It's like God has given me capacities and abilities, and I should exercise them. That coupled with humility, because I went to public schools, and in public schools, you know what, if you had a decent pedigree and you scored high on testing and all of this, they wanted you in college and going for PhDs and the whole load, they immediately push you that direction. Okay, well, can do with humility, honesty with discretion. You know, why do I pair these two together? Well, to speak honestly and not just be honest as a businessman, but to be a person who is honest, full of honesty and truthfulness, okay? Discretion, meaning there's a way to use that honesty, compassion and discipline. Love, but knowing how to do hard things and ask hard things of people. And mind you, if I could just push the pause button there just a moment. The mix here is incredible, because what you want is you want students to see you love them, but ask things of them. And you want them to learn this same capacity. So there's more caught than taught, you might say. So my son Kyle here teaches phys ed, and maybe a couple of you might have been in that class, I don't know, but he's a long distance runner. He's run marathons. So when he asks things of students, well, they know immediately. I hope he asks it in kindness and generosity and all such like, but there's a natural inclination to actually try to follow that direction, because the teacher has knows something about discipline along these lines. So love mixed with discipline, discernment, and forgiveness. We could talk a long time here on this point, but I can see time will run out real fast here, so I need to keep moving. Methods. The example of the teacher I've already spoken to. Memorization with purpose. And by that, a little concern I have, across some of our schools at least, Bible memory has become less important. I'm a little concerned about that, just to be very, very honest with you. I grew up in a day when it was really important, or in the schools I taught at, it was important. Some schools made it so important that they had quizzes and this and that related to them, and somehow or another, I wasn't quite sure that if that got at what we wanted to get at. Memorization with a purpose, I think, is like perhaps memorizing Psalm 91 during a COVID-19 crisis. Okay, and just saying, look, we're not answering the questions here about COVID-19, but we are saying, here's a psalm that teaches us something about how we deal with sickness and how we think about it within God's perspective. That's what I mean, memorization with purpose. Story, personal and otherwise. This has been emphasized in recent years, and it's just so true. We remember stories. Okay, that's just, we're designed that way. Well, if that's the case, then obviously the teacher, this is a method in the back door. It's a story that illustrates the point, the values. So how much land does a man need? Who writes that thing?
Tolstoy.
Tolstoy, that's right. Tolstoy is the writer there. So there's a story. It's short, it's neat, you can read it quickly, and it makes a point that it's hard for you to make without the story. Learn how to use him powerfully. So small group discussion skills. I don't want to hammer on this one too hard. Some of you have heard me talk about it. When I went to Chambersburg Area Senior High School, I don't know the number of times I sat in a small group I could put on one hand. Okay, they didn't even do them in public schools. My teaching style is not geared all very much that direction, but I'm a pastor too, and I do know that one of the best ways for people to actually interact at a heart level is in relatively small groups, talking with each other about life, and particularly if you can add a little bit, at least, of accountability into that somehow. Our schools have a chance at least of opening the door to the capacity for a youngster, this teenage boy who maybe keeps everything to himself, gives him a chance to sit with a group of people and actually talk about life a little bit. I'd encourage you to work on this type of thing. Again, what'd you say, first and second grade? You know what they do here at FBCS? I never administrated this, but Mr. Miller over here, they have chapel groups. And chapel groups, they inaugurate right at the beginning of the year, so that has an older student in all the way down to a grade one. That's not their main small group sharing thing, but it's a place where a child, a first grader, actually gets a chance to sit with some other students and hear them talk about life and this and that and the other thing, and work on projects like they do in chapel groups and so on. Okay, I just push it out there, not as an experienced person in this, but particularly pastorally, I know the power of this. And really encourage, let me be careful here. Some, I know teachers in who are so small group oriented, they don't teach, but they just do small groups. For me, it'd be a cop out. Yeah, I'm a teacher. I do have some information, I hope, to pass on to the next generation. And so my tendency is toward lecture. But I'm not stupid. There's power in the small group. Okay? And it's a good skill to learn how to do that. Accountability structures at work. I'm going to now just let that stand for what it's worth here. Right at the moment, but a big thing here. Maybe just one comment on it. This is from a pastoral standpoint. So I've worked with the pornography issue a bit among our people, and while there's an awful lot of accountability stuff that exists, but there's not an awful lot that really works. Okay, and I don't want to go into more details about it right now, but that's something I think that our people need to work on. Well, to be really frank, so my father never went to a coffee house, period. They didn't have them back in the day. I go to them. I go and sit down with people and talk. If I were to point a finger of criticism at the current generation, it's that coffee houses and talk, oftentimes end right there. Okay? I want to see the talk. It's funny, if you actually learn the language and you learn how to use the language and you learn how to talk in small groups, but you never really make any, there's no real dramatic. The next time you get together, you sob at each other's shoulder again, pat each other on the back, and nothing changes. Yeah, I have a little concern about that. I just put it out there for whatever it's worth and say, my concern is that small groups really do have some built-in accountability to them. And we learn how to do that so that it does result in genuine discipleship. So don't see that as the job of the school, but hear me saying that schools have an opportunity to crack the door open for young folks to enter into these kind of relationships and accountability and do well. Patience, James 5:7, already kind of alluded to this. Some of you are very young here. I don't think anybody's as old as I am. I alluded to this just in my introduction here, and that is, be patient with students. Be patient beyond grad, or from 8th grade, or 10th grade, or 12th grade, whatever it is, and keep bridges in place. Okay, I think I can say with integrity that I can't think of a student that I've had in my 42 years of teaching that I have a really, really bad relationship with. As far as I know, they're all open. I have to tell you this one, speaking of the long arc. So we had some community folks come to this school here. I won't tell you the story, but I really had a confrontation with one of those gals one day. I mean, it was a serious confrontation. End of the day, this girl's married today, and I was in town at one of the stores here, you know, I don't know, 5 years ago or so. So she would have been here at school 20 years ago. We were in Value City or one of those places that I could see over the racks, so you know that they were low. My wife and I are walking down through the store, and all of a sudden, clear across, this is a big apartment store, clear across the store, Mr. Lehman, and I'm like, and here it's this gal that would have kind of been a reason for us to sort of have a tiff, and she had two or three children in tow, and she'd come running over there, and I bet she was the gushiest lady you ever saw in your life. And I'm like, well, okay. Well, I guess we're doing okay. But be patient is the point here. Now, I need to leave this, and I'd like to at least finish off with the motto that I use, or the model that I use. I remind myself, I tried to do this particularly when I was teaching, at least one time per week, consider at least the model here. And let me, I need to skip some here for the sake of time, but let's take a look here. So this comes from Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 10, and the verse there is, as an eagle stirreth up her nest, fluttereth over her young, spreadeth about broad her wings, taketh them, beareth them on her wings, so the Lord led. And years ago when I was reading this, I thought to myself, wow, so that's the way the Lord teaches. Right there we have the model. What's that about? If that's the way he teaches, that's the way I ought to teach. And a really, really wonderful metaphor here that I offer to you. What it's about is, and you don't have all of these slides, so because I didn't want to put them all in there, but this is a bald eagle. What's referenced here is a Middle Eastern eagle, actually, as you might expect from Moses. And it's talking about the way they do their nesting thing. And it works this way. This is the very short version. So they begin. So, you know, eagles mate for life, right? That's a good point to begin with. And so time comes for a hatch to actually exist, and mom and dad, they begin to build a nest. You can't quite tell from this nest, maybe out here along the edge you can. The picture I'm seeing, you can see it quite well. But these are big, probably, I don't know, twice as big as your thumb is their beginning foundation for their nest. And if you've ever seen these eagle nests, they're probably 10 feet across. There's one right down the road here a little ways. And they build this really strong foundation under them of big, heavy sticks. The next thing is what's really fascinating to me is they go and they find brambles, blackberry bushes or thorn bushes or whatever they can find that has sharp points on it, and they haul those in, and that's the next layer in the nest. You can't even see it on here, okay? And then they proceed with this fine stuff that you see. And this may be grass or fairly heavy weeds, but generally soft. And they put that as a third layer. So heavy layer, thorns, then a light layer, or at least a comfortable layer. And then mom finishes off by pulling down out of her body, and she lines that whole thing. So there's four layers here, all the way up. Okay, and of course, time goes along, eggs are laid, and little eaglets are born. or hatched, I guess is the right terminology there. And they're hatched and they're fed and they grow and they begin to get feathers. And Sheila and I watched these down here about just beyond where you had your the cabin. If you go down there about another 2 miles, you could, there's actually one that you can see. And all this happens and they get their feathers and those little eaglets are in there. And then one day mom says to, time for something to happen. And what she does is she gets down in the nest and she starts to squish and scratch and dig around and push a few things back. And those little eaglets, the next thing you know, they're just a little exposure there. And the next thing they find out, the safest place here is up on the edge of the nest because it's ouchy in there. And so up on the edge of the nest, they go. And once they get up there to the edge of the nest, and I didn't actually see this happen with my eyes, but we saw these the bald eagles down here, and they were big, but they weren't flying yet. They were they just sit up there on the edge of the nest. This Middle Eastern one, what happens there is the mom actually pushes them off. She just when she gets it figured out, they just go to work. She just pushes them off, and they down they go. And if they don't spread their wings and fly, she flies down right underneath them and catches them on her back. Okay, and that's not one of that's actually, I couldn't find a good picture of it, but here, this has a blackbird riding on the back of a, on the back of an eagle, but she catches the little ones and brings them right back and dumps them right back in the nest, and they're back up on the edge of the nest, and she pushes them off again. Okay, until they learn to fly. I don't know how many disasters they have. I can't tell you what the rate of success is here, but that's how they go about teaching them to fly. Now, if you go back and look at the verse, you can immediately see how it makes a lot of sense. So, as an eagle stirreth up her nest, okay, stirs up that nest, fluttereth over her young, spreadeth abroad her wings, some versions will say bears them on the pin on her pinions, I believe is some of the wording that's used there. Taketh them, beareth them on her wings, so alone the Lord did lead them. So I really like that metaphor, and I'm being quick here, I'm out of time, but I want you to see the five and things that are the words I use for the long arc. Number one, what's the best mean? Security. Every classroom has to have a sense of security there. I don't have time to tell the story, but I could tell you some stories in my school life where the teacher didn't pick up on that there were some bullies in the classroom and students were afraid of those bullies. And so that introduces insecurity. I can tell you that the learning level goes from, if it was a level 7 before, it just dropped to level 4 with that kind of insecurity actually in the classroom. Okay, so classroom management, whatever the nuts and bolts are, they need to end up, the student feels safe and secure in that classroom. Nothing's going to get out of control here and so on. You can see why an angry teacher or a teacher who cannot control their temper, that's not going to work. It immediately creates insecurity. We never know what's coming next. Okay, secondly, belonging and identity. Can't help but tell you ladies this. Here's an exercise for you to do. Because I did this, and I found a surprising result back early in 5 years, 10 years maybe into my teaching career. Sit in the back of your classroom after school. Students are gone. Sit in the back of your classroom if you're a homeroom teacher. And what I would do is think I wasn't as good as Christopher Dock. You know, he would pray for every one of them every evening. I can't make that kind of claim. And I only did this once a week. Sit back there and, okay, Sally, Jay, Tom, Bill, and ask yourself this question. When was the last time I talked to that person? Had a personal conversation with that student? And I don't mean a coffee shop conversation. I mean, just, I stopped them and personally asked them, oh, so how's it going with fill in the blank. Okay. Even a short conversation. Guess who I missed? I began to see a pattern. You gals aren't going to like it at all, because I almost guarantee you there's a number of you in here. It was the young lady who always had her work done, who was never late, who was quiet, generally quiet, reserved. And I said, you know what? Those are the people I don't talk to. It wasn't because I was afraid of them. Teachers, remember something. Never give all of your attention to the brat in the classroom. That's what he wants anyway. Don't do that. pay attention, think through who it is that you don't have a connection with in, and create some connections there. Everybody is happier when they belong, when they know they're wanted. I don't even have to say much about this. Whether it's church or whether it's family or whether it's classroom, identity belonging is a big deal. And I want all of my students, you're here and I'm so glad you're here. and I care about you. Okay? You want to work on that. Trust needs to be built. Said enough about that. And I'm just over time right now, so I must keep moving here. Discipline, the will to correct. We all know this, but it is hard to practice. And that is when we truly love, we are willing to discipline. Okay? Yeah. And by the way, there's a great deal of security right there. That is very hard for a youngster to articulate. But when we get older, we realize that when our dads, who had our good in mind and actually were willing to say, no, you're not doing that. They did that because they loved us. The will to discipline. Growth, measurable progress. So the eaglet grows up and actually develops the capacity to fly. Okay, so a maturity, that direction. I only feel like my job is done when I see students being capable of learning on their own. Okay, my job's not done until that's in place. I'm still not done even then, but I'm just saying that's when you know you're getting somewhere. Maturity, a growing capacity to independent living and learning, like I just got done saying. And I need to stop right there, except to say this. They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. I missed the slide I wanted. Now just give me a moment. My final piece on that is to teach them to fly. So the long arc is really a student whose heart is in the right place and has learned to fly on their own. And what a beautiful thing. So, sorry to keep you 5 minutes over time there, but there's perhaps a few ideas that you can take home with you. Think through that nest thing, and if you can create some of that in your classroom, I can tell you you're on the ark somewhere. And trust God. Let's do pray together. Father, I want to pray for each teacher represented in this classroom, whether we be moms, dads, teachers in the classroom, grandpas, Lord. Dear Lord, give us a heart for the rising generation. Not only that, give us a heart for our communities, parents, and even those who are very young here, maybe first-year teachers, second, third, I don't know. Lord, give them wisdom and grace in the heat of the day to think about this long arc. Maybe for a few moments, catch a vision of Sammy as a 25-year-old or a 30-year-old or maybe taking his place in the community, a dad, a pastor. Lord, help us just to have enough vision to give us the energy that we need for the day as we engage with students. And I pray for the greatest success across the country and for each classroom represented here.
and patience and kindness and generosity and compassion and all that is involved there. We entrust these things to you in Christ. Amen.
Well, God bless you as you teach this year. Sheila and I try to pray for teachers pretty regularly, so I probably don't know most names here, but we're going to offer up a few for you. You are dismissed.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.